Shaving a few grains of material from the torque proved to be a simple task with the help of the laser. Sebastian collected the sample and moved over to the mass spectrometer. Sebastian placed the sample inside the device and then fired up the computer that was a part of the unit.
The first thing we're going to do is vaporize the sample, producing a gas that includes all of its component elements. The gas will then be exposed to an electron beam, which will charge the molecules of the gas and convert them into ionized particles.
There was a brief flash of light from inside the spectrometer as the first step he mentioned took place. He barely acknowledged it, continuing his explanation while manipulating various controls through the computer.
The ionized particles will be exposed to a series of magnetic fields that will sort the ions by their masses. The detector will then provide a quantitative analysis of the ions present.
Good-looking and intelligent.
In the end, we should know exactly what our legendary blacksmith used to manufacture the torque.
He set a few more switches and then sat back to wait. Finally, after almost an hour of waiting, though it only seemed like 10 or 15 minutes to Anya, the spectrometer churned out its results. Sebastian picked up the report off the printer and began paging through it.
Pretty consistent with an achondritic meteorite, just as we suspected. Iron, nickel in limited quantities, some silica formations, and various assorted minerals.
Sebastian, what is it?
He looked up from the paper, a dazed expression on his face.
Plutonium.
What? Did you say plutonium?
Sebastian nodded, his attention still on the report in front of him. He was tracing the lines of information with one finger, then double-checking the numbers against a reference volume he'd pulled from a nearby shelf.
No doubt about it. In fact, it is probably one of the purest samples I've ever seen outside of a nuclear laboratory.
Plutonium is virtually non-existent in nature. You can sometimes find it in uranium, but only in the tiniest trace amounts.
I know, Anya, but I'm telling you, the torque has one hell of a lot of plutonium in it.
Can the spectrometer be malfunctioning? Or calibrated incorrectly or something?
There's one way to find out.
Sebastian got up and began digging through the cabinets on a nearby wall. After a few minutes of searching, he returned with a small handheld device about the size of a waffle iron. A cord attached a small wand to the device. Anya immediately recognized it as a Geiger counter. Stepping back over to the laser, where the torque still rested, Sebastian turned on the counter and waved the wand over the torque. Nothing happened.
What? Wait a minute. Oh, it isn't charged.
Endearingly absent-minded, intelligent, and good-looking. Wonder if he has dinner plans.
I'll just plug it in.
Anya knew what that meant without having to be told. The torque was radioactive. Sebastian and his spectrometer were both right. As crazy as it sounded, the torque had been fashioned from a meteorite that consisted primarily of naturally produced plutonium. Anya looked at Sebastian, expecting him to answer his phone, but he shook his head.
Not mine.
Surprised, Anya realized it was her new phone. She hadn't heard it ring before and didn't recognize the sound. She dug it out of her backpack.
Hello?
If you expect me to call back, it is generally a good idea to actually leave me the number where I can reach you.
Rue!
As it turned out, Rue was right. In all the craziness that was going on, she'd forgotten to leave her new cell phone number with him when she'd called. She endured a few minutes of scolding. As her mentor and friend, she figured he was entitled.
I've been seeing your name all over the press, Anya. Just what have you gotten yourself into this time?
Hang on. I'm sorry, I've got to take this call.
He flashed his megawatt smile again.
Of course. Why don't you use the reception area where you'll have a little privacy? I'll continue working on these results.
Seated in the back of his limousine with Henshaw at the wheel, Rue listened to Anya's story, and as he did, the pieces of the puzzle he'd been struggling to understand finally fell into place.
Where are you now, Anya?
In Paris, at the offices of Dr. Sebastian Cartier, a geologist I've hired to analyze the chemical composition of the torque. And get this, we've just discovered that the torque was fashioned from a meteorite full of plutonium.
Plutonium? Give me his address.
Forget the meeting. This was too important.
Henshaw and I are going to...
Rue trailed off in mid-sentence as the memory of the last conversation he'd overheard in Shaw's office replayed in his mind.
She'll be at this address in the morning. Recover my property, and then get rid of her. What about the geologist?
Get rid of him too.
You've got to get out of there, Anya. Drop everything but the talk and get out of there now!
What's going on, Rue?
Shaw knows you're there, and he's already sent his men to recover the talk. No matter what, you can't let that happen.
Shaw? Who the hell is Shaw? And how do you know someone is after the torque?
She was just about to demand that Rue explain himself, whether he wanted to or not, when she happened to glance out the front window. She was just in time to see a group of armed gunmen wearing black face masks exit the van parked across the street and head directly for the walkway leading to Sebastian's front door.
We're too late, Rue. Shaw's men are already here.
She then ran for the back room, calling her sword to her as she went. Sebastian looked up as Anya burst into the room, and she saw his eyes go wide at the medieval sword in her right hand. She didn't have time to explain. She pointed at a door on the other side of the room.
Run!
He just stood there, holding the test results in one hand and a pen in the other, staring at her in amazement.
What's going on?
She dashed across the room and grabbed the torque from inside the cutting crib. Sebastian tore his gaze away from her and looked toward the front of the house, uncertain.
In another 30 seconds, armed gunmen are going to come swarming through that door looking for this torque. We need to be somewhere else when that happens.
Sebastian hurried over to the door on the far side of the room, Anya close at his heels.
Is there a back way out?
They left the lab and its equipment behind and headed deeper into the building down another short corridor.
Yes.
They hurried forward to the rear exit, half hidden in the shadows against the far wall.
This will lead us out in the alley.
Sebastian reached for the knob.
Wait!
The gunman only lived a few seconds longer than his victim. Others approached, firing as they came. Anya released the sword, snatched the gun away from the dying man's hand, dragged Sebastian's body clear of the doorway, and then kicked the door shut. Bullets slammed into the other side, but the door held up under the assault. Anya took one look at Sebastian and knew he was gone. His eyes stared blankly at the ceiling above.
How do I get out of here?
She glanced at the gun in her hand, an MP5. She hit the release and let the magazine fall into her other hand, noting its weight.
About half full. Gotta make every shot count.
She slapped it back into place as she raced into the lab. The door leading to the reception area was still open, giving her a clear view all the way to the front of the building. Several figures stomped through the front door. Anya dashed over to the workstation closest to the other door and took up position behind it. She pointed the gun in the direction of the intruders. Bullets chewed into the walls, floor, and ceiling. Two of the intruders were trying to gain ground while she kept her head down.
No, you don't.
Anya glanced back the way she had come and saw three men crossing the storage area, headed for the door to the lab. The lead gunman saw her. Anya put a bullet into the gunman's face. As the dead man fell back against the others, struggling to get by him, Anya scrambled over and behind a different workstation, bringing her within arm's distance of the door to the back hallway. The first of the intruders moved cautiously forward into the room, his gun held out in front of him. The screaming startled the man behind him, which gave Anya the split second she needed. That should even up the odds a bit, she thought with satisfaction. Anya whirled at the sound of clattering and saw a round, egg-shaped object as it came to rest against one of the other workstations. She dove for the cabinets. As Rue and Henshaw approached the address, they saw two dark-colored vans pull away from the curb and speed off in opposite directions. For a moment, Rue considered giving chase. If they were Shaw's men and they had the torque, this might be the only chance he would have to take them out. But his concern for Anya overrode his instincts, and he watched them disappear down the street, unhindered. Henshaw pulled to a stop in front of the house. Rue bolted out of the car and dashed toward the entrance.
Anya!
What remained of the door hung in shards, and from the walkway, Rue could see the room just inside, a reception area of some kind, had been riddled with gunfire. The air stank of cordite.
Anya!
He took a few steps forward. There were two exits, one to his left that opened into an office, and another dead ahead that looked like it would take him deeper into the building. He could see into the room on his left, a ransacked office that appeared empty. He chose the other way out of the reception area. A narrow hallway stretched out ahead of him, and it was there that he found the first two bodies. It was obvious they were both male. The doors on either side of the hallway were locked, which left him only the direct route ahead. Rue knew he didn't have much time. The room at the end of the hall was in even worse shape. Cabinets barely clung to the walls, their exteriors riddled with bullet holes. The ceiling and part of the wall in the far corner had collapsed, burying the cabinets beneath an avalanche of wood, plasterboard, and ceiling tiles. Sticking out of the pile of debris was the lower half of a woman's leg, wearing blue jeans and a familiar style of hiking boot.
Anya!
Drew rushed over and quickly dug her out. Her face was covered in blood. For a moment he feared the worst. But then he noticed the steady rise and fall of her chest and knew she was merely unconscious. The blood was from a sizable cut at her hairline. She was clearly bruised and battered, but she was alive, and for that he was thankful.
Home or the hospital?
Hospital.
Definitely a hospital, just not one the public knew about. As Henshaw drove, Rue picked up his cell phone again and made the call that he'd been putting off since earlier that morning.
Detective Inspector Beresford, please.
Detective Inspector Beresford is on another line at the moment, sir. Would you like to leave a message?
No, I'll hold. It is urgent that I speak with him. Please tell him it's about the Arkholm case.
Beresford?
My name is Rue, Inspector. And I believe it is time you and I had a short chat.
Anya lurched upright, thinking she was still in the midst of the firefight.
Anya! Anya!
Rue's familiar voice brought her to full wakefulness, and she glanced about, taking in her surroundings, noting Rue standing off to one side, prudently out of reach of her sword.
Oh. Oh.
She was in a hospital, that much was obvious. An IV tube ran into her left arm, and her head and ribs were bandaged. Her body, beneath her hospital gown, felt beaten and bruised, but her thoughts, now that she was awake, flowed surprisingly clear. She remembered the phone call from Rue, warning her to get out of the geologist's offices before Shaw's men arrived.
How did he learn they were coming? How deeply was he involved?
Anya kept her sword in hand, her gaze locked on Rue.
What happened?
Rue's eyes narrowed slightly as he realized she was not putting her weapon away.
By the time Henshaw and I arrived, the mongrels who attacked you had fled, taking the Tork with them. We managed to extricate you from the scene before the police arrived and brought you here.
And here is...
A private hospital outside of Paris. The kind of place that caters to those who do not wish to have their business aired in public.
She hated to ask, but she had to know.
Sebastian?
Rue shook his head. She watched Rue carefully.
You knew they were coming.
I was offered a chance to bid on an artifact, one that might have some unusual powers attributed to it. As I dug into the offering, it became clear that the man running the auction, David Shaw, was up to something untoward, and I made it my mission to find out what that was. By the time I discovered the connection between you, the talk, and Shaw's activities, it was almost too late. I warned you as quickly as I could, and then did my best to extract you from this situation.
He was telling the truth. She could feel it in her bones. Rue stepped forward, coming over to her bedside.
The doctor said you should drink this when you woke up.
What is it?
It's just water, Anya. Nothing more sinister than that.
She smiled back at him, the initial awkwardness between them already forgotten. She took the glass, and it was only when she held its cool surface in her hands that she realized how thirsty she was.
This guy's Shaw. Do you know how to find him?
At the moment, no, but I have people working on that. Unfortunately, we have a much bigger problem on our hands.
And that is?
Anya glanced at Rue, her mind already halfway to calling the sword to her side, but he shook her off, gesturing that she should cover herself up with the blanket. As she did so, the door opened, revealing a short, stocky man with gray hair standing in the doorway. His shirt and suit had been well-pressed at the start of his shift, but since that was 48 hours ago, he was starting to look a bit worse for wear. Anya knew this because she'd seen him in the same suit the night before, giving a press conference regarding the events in Arkholm. Detective Inspector Ian Beresford looked them over, then stepped into the room.
It's good to see you still alive, Miss Creed.
Without waiting for an answer, the detective turned to her companion.
You must be Rue.
To her surprise, Rue stepped forward and shook the detective's hand.
Thank you for coming, Detective Inspector. I appreciate your willingness to meet with us on such short notice.
Beresford's face was a carefully controlled mask.
You made a persuasive argument for doing so, Mr. Rue.
It's Rue. Just Rue.
Indeed. How interesting.
If you two are done fencing with each other, maybe one of you could tell me what the hell is going on.
I'd like to hear that as well.
Rue pointed at the chair in the corner.
Why don't you have a seat, Inspector? I have a hunch that this will take a while.
It took more than an hour, as it turned out, as the three exchanged their knowledge of the previous day's events and their perpetrators. For the most part, Beresford listened carefully as the story unfolded, letting each of them speak, and only occasionally interrupting to ask a question if he didn't understand something and fill in gaps in information. It was only when Rue mentioned Perchenko by name that Beresford acted surprised.
Ivan Perchenko? The arms dealer?
Rue nodded.
Acting on some information I received, I followed Shaw last night and witnessed him buying a piece of what I took to be surplus military equipment from Perchenko.
Do you have any idea what that equipment might be?
I do. Suspecting something was amiss, I decided to question Perchenko myself. After some conversation, he revealed to me that he sold Shaw a Cold War-era RA-115, which, in plain English, is a portable nuclear device, or suitcase nuke.
Is the device operational? And is Perchenko still able to answer questions on the subject?
Perchenko thought he'd pulled a fast one over on Shaw. The device had been rendered inert by the Soviet military years before, and he found it remarkably funny that Shaw had been willing to pay for a piece of equipment that was useless without the plutonium necessary to activate it.
Beresford visibly relaxed as Rue continued.
Figuring the authorities might be interested in hearing what they had to say for themselves, I left Perchenko and his bodyguard securely locked in the basement of a facility outside of Paris late last night.
Anya could not believe what she was hearing. From what she'd put together, it looked like this guy Shaw was clearly a member of the Red Hand Defenders, possibly even their leader. She'd thought the Torque's mystical properties were what made it so attractive to the organization, but now she understood that it was much more down-to-earth than that. Apparently, it was the Torque's plutonium base that was of interest to them, and not its alleged mystical qualities.
I'm not sure I want to know what it took to wring that admission out of him, but I guess I should thank you for your efforts. CT Command has been watching Perchenko closely for the past few years and hasn't been able to pin anything definitive on him. With your testimony, we should be able to put him away for a good number of years.
Rue shook his head.
I am afraid we don't have time for that, Detective Inspector. Anya, would you be good enough to share what you learned about the talk before it was taken from you?
Beresford turned to face her, a look of confusion on his face. Clearly, he didn't understand where this was going.
After testing it with a mass spectrometer and a Geiger counter, we found the torque contained plutonium. A lot of plutonium. How Shaw knew about it, I don't know. But it's clear that is why he wants the necklace.
Beresford's face got more and more pale as she spoke, until he looked like he'd seen a ghost. Perhaps, like Scrooge, he was seeing the ghosts of things to come. The idea that a working nuclear device had fallen into the hands of the Red Hand Defenders, an organization that hadn't shied away from targeting Catholic school teachers and postal workers, for heaven's sake, was nearly unthinkable.
There's nothing we can do. We have no proof.
Anya, who'd pulled on a robe and gotten out of bed to pace back and forth with tired little strides of her aching body, whirled to face him.
Nothing you can do? Are you insane? Call out the freaking army, for heaven's sake. Terrorists have a nuclear bomb, and for all we know, they're getting ready to use it against the City of London.
It doesn't matter, Miss Crade. This is a country of laws. We don't bend them to suit our needs like your country tends to do. All I have right now are statements from the two of you, which, in a court of law, will be practically useless. Need I remind you that you're a potential suspect in a multiple homicide? Never mind that your companion here has all but admitted to kidnapping and holding the principal subject against his will. The magistrate will throw the case out of court before I can even get a word in edgewise.
Rue's brow furrowed, and Anya knew he was trying to reconcile his 15th century ideas of right and wrong with the modern legal code.
Would it help if I give you a written record of the discussion I had with Mr. Petchenko? Would that convince you?
Beresford held up a hand, visibly trying to get his emotions under control. When he had, he turned to face them both.
You don't need to convince me, Rue, nor you, Anya. I believe you both. Who would make up a story as crazy as this? It's so ludicrous that I've got no choice but to believe it. But that's not the problem.
Anya understood immediately and tried to explain it to Rue.
Detective Inspector Beresford also has to convince those above him in the chain of command that there is an urgent threat. And if the only proof he has at his disposal is our word, then he'll be hard-pressed to make anyone listen.
Quite right, Miss Creed.
Anya had never in her entire life wanted to be more wrong.
There has to be something we can do. We can't let Shaw just disappear with a tactical weapon like that. We have to stop him.
Beresford nodded his agreement.
I'll do what I can to sound the alarm. Someone somewhere has to listen to me. But at the moment, my hands are tied until I get that official go-ahead. Shaw runs a multi-million dollar corporation. The powers that be aren't going to take kindly to me accusing him of being the mastermind behind an Irish terrorist group. Never mind one with a bomb that big and that scary.
Perhaps there is something we can do in the meantime.
Talk to me. As you Americans say, I'm all ears.
Their first order of business was to figure out where Shaw's henchmen took the torque. That, at least, was something Beresford could work on without waiting for approval from those higher up the food chain. He didn't waste any time getting in touch with the French authorities in charge of the crime scene at Cartier's office and suggesting, one detective to another, that they be on the lookout for two dark-colored vans that left the scene just before law enforcement officers arrived. When asked what he knew about the incidents, Beresford said that it appeared to be related to a series of previous incidents under investigation by New Scotland Yard and promised he'd be in touch later with more information. That seemed to satisfy them, and he was confident that they'd let him know if and when they found anything. He then called his partner, Clements, and ordered him to place Shaw's home and the Vanguard offices in London under a round-the-clock observation, citing a link to the Arkholm case as justification. Given that no one expected Shaw to remain in France, they turned their attention to getting out of the country and back to England. Beresford suggested taking Anya into protective custody and bringing her across the channel as an official guest of the Metropolitan Police Service. But doing so would require the cooperation of the French authorities, who might then want to question her in connection with the Cartier homicide. None of them were ready to let Anya's involvement in that situation become public knowledge yet, as doing so might tip Shaw to the fact that a witness to both the initial attack and the killing of Sebastian Cartier still lived. Right now, Shaw wasn't looking for her, no doubt believing that she perished along with Cartier. But that would change rather quickly if he learned that she was alive and talking with the police. While they were still debating their options, Anya's doctor arrived for her afternoon rounds. Dismissing the other men from the room, the doctor gave her a thorough examination, paying close attention to the cut on her head and the injury to her ribs. She removed the bandage from her head, cleaned the wound with some antiseptic gel, then covered it up again with a fresh bandage. When she finished, she turned her attention to Anya's ribs.
Ah.
Unwrapping the bandages let her know she was more sensitive than she'd realized.
Tell me if this hurts.
She gently pressed against Anya's ribcage with one hand.
Ah!
Pain exploded like a supernova in her head, blacking out the room and everything in it. When she came back to herself, she found the doctor standing over her, a look of concern on her face.
Definitely, yes. That hurt you, I see.
Anya nodded weakly.
You have several cracked ribs and some serious blunt trauma damage to your torso.
She removed the IV line and taped a bandage over the slight puncture it left behind.
Unfortunately, other than wrapping it up again, there is not much we can do for it. It will heal, but it is going to take time. I'd suggest several weeks of nothing more strenuous than bed rest. Though, based on your reputation, I'd say I'd be lucky if you stayed off your feet for a day.
After a painful shower, Anya stood beside the bed, pulling on a new pair of sweatpants she'd taken from a pile of clothes Henshaw supplied, when Garin Braden suddenly strode into her hospital room. As was typical, he didn't bother to knock.
No need to get dressed on my account.
Anya stared at him in surprise.
In fact, I think I'd prefer that you didn't.
The thought of being undressed around Garin made her unexpectedly blush, which simply ticked her off. Thankfully, the towel she was wearing covered the vast majority of her body.
And I'd prefer that you learned to knock, you ass. Turn around while I finish getting dressed.
Anya dropped the towel, glaring at the back of his head and mentally daring him to turn around as she pulled on a dark blue t-shirt. The truth was that she found Garin Braden far too interesting for her own good. That he was devilishly handsome wasn't justification enough, particularly since she was well aware that a devil's heart beat in his breast. His black hair and perfectly groomed goatee gave him a suave, debonair appearance, but she knew he'd kill without a second thought if it served his purposes. Like Rue, Garin had been present at Joan's death. Somehow, he had been bound up along with Rue in whatever mystical force the sword spawned when the English who held Joan captive had shattered the sword. For centuries, the two men alternated between trying to kill each other and being grudging friends and occasional partners. Anya somehow adopted them when the sword adopted her.
You can turn around now.
Garin must have seen her reaction, but he gave no sign of having done so, which she appreciated. He was a warrior and hated to show weakness, so by extension, he thought she wouldn't want to either. It was a thoughtful gesture in its own unique way, and it was those little things that made her wonder what else he hid beneath that decidedly deadly exterior.
Can you walk, or do I need to get a wheelchair?
Are we going somewhere?
Unless you'd prefer to spend the rest of your days in the hospital.
Garin opened the door, checked to be sure the hallway was clear, and then gestured that she follow him. She knew Garin wouldn't be here unless Rue had called him. She just didn't know why. She assumed it had something to do with getting them all out of France. As the head of a multi-million-dollar empire, Garin could call up all kinds of resources at a moment's notice. Resources neither Anya nor Rue could access. Moments later, Anya found herself in a sleek-looking, black-painted helicopter, with the logo of a golden dragon in flight emblazoned on the tail. In addition to Garin and herself, the aircraft carried Rue and Beresford. A medium-sized black man with a shaved head and wraparound shades greeted her with a smile.
A pleasure to see you again, Miss Creed.
And you too, Matthew Griggs.
Griggs was a senior commander in Garin's high-tech security firm, Dragon Tech Security, and had shown himself to be extremely capable whenever she'd encountered him. She wasn't just being polite. It felt good to have a team of competent people around after being alone and on the run. They landed at a private airfield south of London. Beresford presented his ID to the customs official who came out to greet the helicopter. They had a short, whispered conversation, and then all were waved through without delay. Two SUVs idled outside the terminal, courtesy of Dragon Tech. Garin got behind the wheel of the first, with Anya, Rue, and Beresford joining him. Griggs and the other men from the helicopter got into the second. Once on the road, they headed for the security firm's London office. They had just settled into the conference room on the third floor when Beresford took a call on his cell phone.
Hello?
30 seconds later, with the help of a computer loaned to them by Garin, they were watching the footage the police observers had captured at the scene. The video showed Shaw and three other men arriving in a dark-colored Mercedes. Shaw headed for the steps, with one of the men in tow, while the other two took a large metal case out of the trunk before following.
Him!
Anya pointed to the man with Shaw.
That's the bastard who shot Craig Stevens and Paolo Novick.
Beresford froze the video for a closer look.
You're sure?
Absolutely.
His name's Trevor Jackson. He's Shaw's right-hand man and bodyguard. As a former member of the SAS, he's not a man to be trifled with.
Oh, I intend to do far more than trifle with him when I see him again.
Beresford turned to Rue.
And is that the device?
Rue studied it for a moment and then nodded.
Yes, that's it.
Rue looked at Garin.
How soon can your men be ready to go?
Would now suffice?
Rue's answering smile was more than a bit wolfish. Garin moved to his desk. He activated the flat-screen monitor that hung on the wall nearby. A building schematic appeared on the screen.
These are the latest blueprints I was able to obtain for the Vanguard building.
He moved the trackball on the mouse, flipping through pages until he reached the one he wanted.
This is the 11th floor, where Shaw has his office. It's the most likely place for him to take the device. There are three points of ingress, here, here, and here.
Wait a minute! What do you think you're doing? And where did you get those blueprints?
Garin frowned, then turned to Anya.
Is he for real?
Anya opened her mouth to say something to calm the situation, but Rue beat her to it.
Inspector Beresford, by your own admission, you do not think you could mobilize a law enforcement response quickly enough to keep the device contained where it is. Is that still correct?
Yes, it's correct, but that doesn't mean I can allow you...
I'm afraid that's actually what it means. Right now, we know where the device is. That might not be the case an hour from now, never mind tomorrow. We do not have time to wait for the bureaucratic red tape to untangle itself. If we are going to stop him, we have to strike, and we have to do it now.
It was clear to Anya that Beresford didn't know what to say. He was frustrated by his official inability to do anything, and yet the idea of having a private security force assault a public place of business must have been making his toes curl.
You asked for an alternate plan. This is it.
Rue turned back to Garin.
Go on.
Anya was still watching Beresford as Garin began laying out the tactical plan for invading the Vanguard offices. At first, it looked like the detective wanted to continue protesting, his law-and-order view of reality not really having room for this kind of thing. Then Anya saw his shoulders droop and knew he had come to the same conclusion as the others in the room. Someone had to do something. Why not them? In the end, the plan was a simple one. Griggs would lead the first team through the front door as a diversion. If they could get to the 11th floor, great. But if they tied up the Vanguard security forces somewhere lower, that was fine too. Meanwhile, Garin would lead the second team out of the helicopter and in from the rooftop, coming down to the 11th floor from above. If possible, the two teams would meet and take Shaw's offices together. Once the device was located, it would be hustled up to the rooftop, where the helicopter would be used to take it to safety. As plans went, it was a good one. It was simple, with limited chance of confusion over what to do, causing something to go wrong unexpectedly. As far as they knew, Shaw was unaware he was being watched. Never mind that anyone knew he had access to a potentially operable nuclear device. His success thus far would make him overconfident. They would use that to their advantage. Twenty minutes later, they were airborne in the same model helicopter they'd used to make the trip from France, but this time it was minus the logo and other identifying marks that might help the authorities track them down after the fact. Below them, Anya could see three black SUVs containing Griggs's men pull out of the parking lot and head east toward the target. She silently wished them luck, then turned to watch their passage through London's night skies. It didn't take the chopper long to reach their target. They made one flyover of the building, and in doing so, discovered their first problem. Initial reports had shown an empty helipad on the rooftop. Now, however, a helicopter occupied the space. The large white V of the Vanguard logo could be seen on its side. There was no talk of aborting the mission, for they all knew they couldn't take the chance of losing track of the device if it left the building.
Looks like we're going to have to use the ropes and rappel to the roof.
They made a great curving arc back toward the building and took up a position several hundred yards away and at an altitude where they wouldn't be noticed by the casual observer on the street. Once there, they slipped into the rappelling harnesses they would need to make the descent and waited for Griggs's signal. It didn't take long.
Way inside and taking fire. Mostly handguns, nothing heavy yet. We should be able to break through and reach the elevators in a few more minutes.
Roger that. We're starting our run.
There was no need for Garin to signal the pilot. He'd been on the same radio channel as the rest of them. Before Garin had even finished his last sentence, the pilot dipped the bird to the left and was taking them in sharply toward the Vanguard building. As soon as the pilot had taken up position, hovering over the rooftop, the door in back was thrown open by one of the Dragon Tech's security team. Ropes were secured to the bar above the door, and one by one they clipped the ropes into their harnesses and disappeared out the door, descending to the roof below. By the time Anya reached the roof, the team leader had the door to the stairwell open, and the group quickly descended into the building's interior. They made their way down two flights of stairs and through a variety of corridors without difficulty, only to stumble directly into a group of Vanguard security men headed for the confrontation on the lower floors. The resulting firefight was short but deadly. When it was over, four of the Vanguard team were dead, with two wounded. Garin and his men stripped them of their weapons and radios, bound the wounded with quick ties, and then continued on their way. The clock was ticking now. There seemed little chance Shaw wouldn't figure something was amiss and try to make his escape, so they had to get to him before he had the chance. After cutting down a short corridor, they emerged into the sales bullpen. Chin-high cubicles filled the area, turning it into a labyrinth of sorts, leading to the executive conference area on the other side. Just beyond that lay Shaw's office, where they hoped to find both him and the Torque. They were halfway across the room, intent on their destination, when the door on the far side of the bullpen suddenly opened, and a group consisting of Shaw, Jackson, and a half a dozen armed men stepped through the door. For a split second, everyone froze. Anya kept to the middle of the pack, close to Garin, which was how she ended up crouched behind a cubicle wall with him.
Look!
On the far side of the room, a door was sliding closed, but through the gap she caught a quick glimpse of Jackson and Shaw, and a metal case being carried by one of them, though she wasn't quite sure who.
If we circle around, we should be able to reach the stairs.
It was either that or let Shaw get away while they were pinned down by his security team. Anya fired several shots at the other side, forcing them to keep their heads down. When she did, Garin slid out of position and disappeared amid the maze of cubicles behind them. Anya waited a moment, joined the others in firing off another blast, and then followed suit. The two of them dashed the last few feet to the exit door and slipped through. They found themselves in another stairwell.
Which way?
Bullets came flying down at them. One bullet ricocheted off the nearby wall and carved a furrow in Garin's calf. Anya waited for a lull in the shooting, then stepped out and fired off a few shots upward. Something came clattering down, bouncing off the railings to land a few steps below her. A glance told her it was a pistol. When no more fire came from above, they cautiously made their way up the stairs to the next floor. Garin went through the door at a rush, Anya close behind, the two of them counting on the fact that Shaw and Jackson would be more concerned with getting away than lying in ambush. Thankfully, their guess was right. They found themselves in a long corridor with doors to either side, and saw Shaw disappearing through the door at the far end. If Anya remembered correctly, that was the staircase they'd used to come down from the roof, which meant Shaw was going for the helicopter they'd seen on the helipad. If he reached it before they did, Garin bolted for the door. Anya, her ribs throbbing, a few steps behind. Garin raced past the last door on the right and up the stairs. As Anya neared the end of the hall, Jackson stepped out of a doorway. Blood trickled out of a wound in his left shoulder. In his right hand, he held a knife the size of a billy club. Anya couldn't see a gun.
Damn you! Won't you ever die?
Jackson hung on the blade. His knife dropped from his hand. The pain in Anya's ribs from holding Jackson on the sword overcame her rage. She released the hilt. The erstwhile Celtic warrior died with a surprised expression on his face. Anya slumped forward onto her knees, gasping for breath through the pain in her ribs and the weight of her loss. She heard footsteps approaching and turned in time to see Griggs and two of his men rushing up the corridor toward her. He helped her to her feet.
Where's Mr. Braden?
Anya lifted her head toward the door at the end of the hall.
He chased Shaw through there.
Griggs turned to the other two.
Go!
Then, taking Anya's elbow in his hand, he helped her along after them. The stairs led up to the roof, and they emerged into the night air on the far side. Anya took it all in with a glance, The case containing the old Soviet RA-115 lay a few feet away, as if tossed aside when Shaw emerged from the stairwell. Shaw leaned out of the rear door of the Vanguard helicopter, gun in hand, firing at Garin Braden, who stood midway between Anya and the helicopter. Garin was in the open, completely exposed, but that wasn't stopping him from returning fire, intent on preventing Shaw's escape. Griggs and his men added their gunfire to Garin's, unleashing a wave of bullets that sprayed across the open doorway where Shaw was crouched. As the helicopter lifted up off the pad and swung itself ponderously around in midair, intending to make a clean getaway, Anya thought she saw Shaw flung backward by the force of a shot, but she couldn't be sure.
He can't get away!
The helicopter was several yards above the building.
We have to stop him!
As if in answer to her cry, a bullet from one of the guns finally found a vulnerable target. Griggs threw himself over Anya, kicking them both to the ground, as shrapnel and other larger parts of the aircraft came whizzing back toward them, carried by the force of the explosion. Griggs helped Anya up, and the two of them were dusting themselves off when Garin walked over to join them.
What happened?
The helicopter exploded.
Garin!
I caught Shaw at the top of the steps. We fought over possession of the device. Apparently, Shaw decided that escaping was more important than retaining control of the suitcase bomb. He cast it aside and ran for the helicopter.
Anya stepped over to the battered steel case and looked inside.
It's not here.
What's not?
The torque.
Shaw must have had it with him in the chopper.
It was about the last thing Anya wanted to hear, but she couldn't ignore the logic. Obtaining another suitcase nuke, while difficult, wouldn't be impossible, she knew. But gaining control of enough plutonium to activate it? That was something else entirely. Anya knew that Shaw likely would not have let something as precious as the torque out of his sight. They'd search his office, but she didn't expect to find anything. The torque was gone. Two nights later, Anya and her broken ribs were recovering at Rue's estate outside of Paris, when Henshaw informed her that she had a phone call from Detective Inspector Beresford.
How are you, Miss Creed?
Doing better, Inspector. And you? I take it you survived the fallout surrounding the events of the other night?
Just barely. I called to let you know that Shaw left behind a mountain of evidence regarding his work as leader of the Red Hand Defenders, more than enough to condemn him in any court of law 3 or 4 times over. We can tie him and his henchman Jackson to several car bombs and kidnappings over the past few years, never mind the attacks at Arkham and against Sebastian Cartier. Given what we have, they'll probably cancel the inquest next week.
That's great, Inspector.
Anya hadn't been looking forward to having to explain it all over again to a group of magistrates. Having done so for Beresford's final report was more than enough in her view. Now it appeared she wouldn't have to.
There's just one thing I don't understand, and it's driving me nuts. How did Shaw know that the torque was plutonium in the first place?
Well, I wouldn't want you to go crazy now, so let me answer that for you. Based on his journals, it appears he was aware of the legends behind the torque, about how the material from which it had been fashioned supposedly came from outside this world. He had men like Paolo Novik on his payroll searching for anything resembling the torque. When it surfaced, it was a simple matter for Novik to run a Geiger counter over it to determine it was radioactive.
Anya wasn't surprised to hear there had been a spy in their midst at the dig site. She was dismayed, however, to learn that the spy had been Novik. The loss of the torque in the explosion still pained her, but she supposed it was for the best. Having it loose in the world might just tempt someone else to try something stupid.
Thank you, Detective, for everything.
My pleasure, Miss Creed. Have a safe trip home.
Anya would be returning to the U.S. to get back to work on a new episode for Chasing History's Monsters. For once, she was actually happy to be leaving Europe behind. It was time to go home, she thought. Munich. The man entered the study with the swift, sure strides of one who had done it 100, nay, 1,000 times before. With but a thin slice of illumination coming in through the open doorway, he made his way to the oak cabinet on the far side of the room. He opened it, pressed 6 digits on a keypad set against the back of the cabinet, and then waited patiently as the wall closest to him swung open, revealing another room behind. The biometric lights came on as he stepped inside, closing the false panel behind him. The room wasn't large, not by modern standards, but it was fair-sized and comfortable. Shelves lined the walls, and on them were displayed a number of valuable treasures. Artwork supposed to have vanished during the fall of Berlin, recovered from a warehouse in Argentina. A selection of ancient weaponry, each item more valuable than the last, not the least of which was a samurai sword known to some as 10,000 Cold Nights. An illustrated Bible said to have been penned by the hand of an angel. A strangely shaped skull kept in a glass case, the 3 empty eye sockets staring out in silent accusation. The room was a veritable storehouse of some of the most valuable finds in human history. The man ignored the collection, however. He'd seen it all before, many times. Instead, he moved to a wooden cabinet against the far wall and opened one of its many drawers. The drawer was lined with velvet and stood empty, just as the man knew it would be. He removed a thin, slender box from the inside pocket of his suit jacket and opened it gently. Inside, on a bed of cotton, lay a black necklace with carved eagle heads as clasps. He knew the legends surrounding it. Fashioned from the tears of a goddess, carried by the warrior queen Boudicca in her rebellion against Rome, rumored to provide the wearer with invincibility in battle. Garin Braden closed the drawer, now holding the tear of the gods.
To hell with the bomb. I came away with the only treasure worth having.
Rogue Angel, Tear of the Gods is a graphic audio production. Rogue Angel trademark, owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited. Used by others under license. Copyright 2011, Worldwide Library. Production copyright 2012, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, Gregory Gorton, Richard Rowan, Alexander Strain, James Lewis, Patrick Bussink, Danny Gavigan, Christopher Sheeran, Bradley Smith, Terrence Aselford, Mort Shelby, Stephen Carpenter, James Konacek, Christopher Graybill, Yasmin Toison, Eric Messner, David Coyne, Alyssa Wilmoth, Kimberly Gilbert, Michael Glenn, Joe Brack, Karen Carbone, and Nathaniel Perry. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry and Brian Rogers. The Rogue Angel theme was composed by Chris Rowan. Book adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. If you enjoyed Rogue Angel, be sure to look for Lilith St. Pro's Dante Valentine series and Elizabeth Moon's Vada's War, available at Rogue Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
In the beginning, the Lord created the earth. Then he rested. In time, the earth became cracked and scarred. And through those cracks rose darkness and shadow and unspeakable evil. The evil spread, and sickness and plague and war and death followed with it. Slowly, hope was lost and darkness threatened to overwhelm. But then, God sent his angels. The Holy Order of the Knights Templar. And at the head of the Legion, Knight Commander Cade Williams. And all the power of heaven followed with him.
Run. Run while you can. One day I will find you, and on that day, there will be a reckoning.
Prepare yourself for a reckoning in the Templar Chronicles, Book 1, The Heretic. Available now in graphic audio.
A reckoning indeed.
Smoke Jensen is one of the most successful ranchers in Colorado, until the winter from hell threatens everything he loves.
Smoke? Are you all right?
I'm fine.
You're worried, aren't you?
I won't lie to you, Sally. We may lose everything.
With everything hanging in the balance, Smoke will be pushed further than he ever has before. But the question is, just how far will he go?
You're gonna hang, mister. I don't know which one of you killed Mr. Clark back there in Etna when you held up the bank, but it don't really matter none who pulled the trigger. Every one of you sons of bitches is just as guilty.
Find out just what kind of man Smoke Jensen really is in The Mountain Man number 34. Betrayal of the Mountain Man. Available now in graphic audio.
Thinking about Smoke, ain't you?
Yeah.
Smoke will be all right. He can take care of himself. You know that.
Yeah, I know it.
You'll find out who done this and get that set right, too.
Unless he...
Unless what?
Parley, have you stopped to think that maybe Smoke did it? Maybe he...
Did it?
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.